Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231, and it's a day after a holiday. It's February 23rd, Wednesday, and we're making pretty good progress through bones. We're going to cover appendicular skeleton in today's lecture, and then next time we're going to cover joints, and that will be the last bit of material for the next test, although the next test doesn't occur during the week that we have the practical exam, which starts, when does that start? It starts next week, Wednesday. So I think I put the test off until after the practicum. But the second test is kind of approaching. All right, so does anybody have any questions at all? Anybody have any questions? All right, let me turn these lights down maybe up front over here. That's good. Oh, that's even better. How's that? Okay. All right, so everybody has seen their first test, their first practicum, and all that kind of stuff. So you can review that again before the next test if you want to just see how the tests are written or whatever. All right, so appendicular skeleton is what we're going to cover today. And remember, if we take all of the skeleton, we can break it down into two main categories. What are the two main regions that make up our skeleton? Axial and appendicular, right? So we're done with the axial skeleton, which includes the skull, vertebral column, rib cage, and sternum, right? So that's axial skeleton. And then the appendicular skeleton includes the bones of the upper appendage and lower appendage, and also girdles. And the two girdles are the pectoral girdle, which is superior, and pelvic girdle, which is inferior. And what's the job of a girdle in terms of the skeletal system? Okay, you could use a definition of just a girdle. A girdle just surrounds something. So the pectoral girdle surrounds the pectoral region. The pelvic girdle surrounds the pelvic region, completely surrounding it. And it's made up of different bones. The pectoral girdle is what we see on this slide right here. Ooh, let me move it over to this screen. Oh, I like that much better. Okay. So the girdles are actually part of the appendicular skeleton. The pectoral girdle has two bones, the clavicle anterior and then the scapula, which is posterior. And the job of a girdle is to attach an appendage to your axial skeleton. That's the whole job of a girdle. So the pectoral girdle attaches the upper appendage to your axial skeleton. Pelvic girdle attaches what? The lower appendage to your axial skeleton. And notice I didn't say arm, right? So the pectoral girdle does not attach the arm to the axial skeleton. That wouldn't be really a bad thing to say, right, for this, but it's really an upper appendage, because what is your arm in anatomy? It's just a small region between your shoulder and your elbow, right? So that's just a small region. But it would be really inappropriate to say that the pelvic girdle attaches your leg to your axial skeleton, because it really doesn't attach your leg to your axial skeleton. What's being attached to your axial skeleton at the pelvic girdle would be your femur is the bone that we're going to get to, but it is the thigh, right? So that region between a hip and a knee is the thigh. So be really careful with those terms. Okay, so back to the pectoral girdle. We've got the clavicle and scapula right here. And the clavicle is an easily fractured bone because it really doesn't move around. It's tightly wedged between the sternum, the manubrium of the sternum, and the acromion, which is on the scapula. Scapula does move a little bit, but not very much. So any lateral force applied to the shoulder can snap this clavicle pretty easily. Notice that it's an S-shaped bone. And it's got two ends, so here's the sternal end and the acromial end. And what you cannot appreciate from these pictures is that these ends look totally different in real life. They look similar in this picture. They both look like the ends are flared out, right? But remember, the acromial end is really flat. It looks more like a knife blade, but the sternal end looks more like the opening of a clarinet or a trumpet, right? If you look at it from edge like this, it's round. But if you look at the acromial end on edge, it's flat. So it's really quite different. And for the practicum, of course, you might have to know either end of the clavicle and also know that this is a clavicle, right? That could be a question. All right, and because of the shape of the bone, when it breaks, fortunately, it breaks anteriorly. It breaks outside of your body. And why do I say that's really fortunate? I mentioned this in lab. Because guess what's right underneath the clavicle? Arteries and veins and even nerves, right? And when your bone is fractured, it's a very sharp object and it could lacerate those big arteries. And since it always breaks anteriorly, it really rarely lacerates those arteries. And that's just something that's been worked out through evolutionary processes. That's really nice. And the name of that artery, this is what I really wanted to mention. That's why it's so important to really know your bones. So even after the test, don't forget your bones. And if you didn't learn your bones before the test, guess what? You're probably going to have to go back and learn your bones after the test so that the rest of the class makes sense. So what's the best time to learn bones?
Now,
before the test, because then you at least get credit for it, right? Don't learn them after the test, even though you have to. All right. The name of that artery is the subclavian artery, because it's what? It's deep through the clavicle. So knowing bones, you'd learn a lot of what? Neuroanatomy and vascular anatomy and muscle anatomy all at the same time. So that's really helpful. All right, the posterior bone in the pectoral girdle is the scapula, and we see the anterior side of the scapula on this view right here, which is what? The deep side. So you have to turn your thinking around a little bit because the scapula is on your back. It's posteriorly located. All right, we can see a depression right here. What do we call a depression in anatomy? A fossa. Sometimes we could call it a cavity, but I prefer fossa. And it accepts the head of the humerus right here, forms the glenohumeral joint or your shoulder joint. So that's sometimes we call that the glenoid fossa or glenoid cavity. All right, let's look at the scapula in particular. So there we see a couple clavicles. So here is the anterior side of a scapula. This is the side that is hard to get at. Why? Why is it hard to appreciate and hard to understand and hard to get at? Because it is the deep part of the scapula, which is anterior. It's really the part that's facing you, but in order to get to it, you'd have to go through the rib cage and the thoracic cavity, right? So it's hard to appreciate. It's just one big deep fossa, and we call that the subscapular fossa. And since you know the name, you also know the name of the muscle that's in this fossa right here. That would be the subscapularis when we get the muscle. So it will make knowing muscles really easy. All right, the other thing you got to know about the scapula, which side is medial and which one is lateral. So it's oriented superior on the top, inferior on the bottom, which you can see by this inferior angle right here. But which border is medial and which is lateral? And how are you going to figure that out if you're blanking it out on a test? There's one landmark that is definitely lateral, and that is the glenoid cavity or glenoid fossa right here, which is what? Accepting the head of the humerus. So that's got to be lateral. So here is the medial margin or medial border that runs up and down the spinous processes of your spinal cord or vertebral column. All right, so then also laterally, this is the prominent feature on the top of your shoulder, the acromion process. And then here's a smaller one, which is anterior. We call that the coracoid process. And these are both for muscle attachments and ligament attachments that help stabilize the shoulder joint. So we see the superior border. Sometimes there's a little notch right here, and we call that the suprascapular notch. So supra means on top of. All right, so if there was a notch down over here, we would call that what? The infrascapular notch. There is no such thing, but that's how you would label that. But you're familiar with what? The supraorbital foramen and infraorbital foramen. The supraorbital foramen or notch would be in the frontal bone, and the infraorbital foramen is in the maxilla. All right, so hopefully maybe you can follow with that discussion. All right, so now let's look at the posterior side of the scapula, and when you're in lab, make sure you take these bones, turn them around upside down, put them backwards, and figure out how they fit on your body. Model it on your body or the skeleton that's up in the front of class or your lab partner's body to see how it fits. Now this one you're a whole lot more familiar with, I hope, because this is the one that has some muscles that are easily massaged. All right, so here is that hard ridge in your scapula. We call that the scapular spine, and at the edge of that ridge we have a process we call the acromion process. On either side of the spine we have some depressions. What do we call a depression in anatomy? A fossa. So here's the supraspinous fossa, here's the infraspinous fossa, using some typical terminology once again, and these fossa contain muscles like the supraspinatus, in the supraspinous fossa, in the infraspinatus, in the infraspinous fossa right here. You don't have to know muscles for the next practicum or next test, but now's a good time to be just a little bit aware of that, right? Okay, and so what do we see? Nice medial border, lateral border, glenoid cavity, and I think that pretty much covers the scapula, but what is noteworthy about the scapula? It's a part of the appendicular skeleton, but what special part of the appendicular skeleton does it form? The pectoral girdle, along with the clavicle, right? So make sure you know all of those different things. There are two tubercles that I want you to be aware of. One is above the glenoid fossa, one is below. So here is the supraglenoid tubercle on top, which is on the superior border of the glenoid fossa, and here's the infraglenoid tubercle. These are going to be important attachment points for muscles that you guys are very familiar with, and I'm sure you've all heard of these before. Like, who's heard of a biceps brachii? Raise your hand. Yeah. And so here is where one of the heads of the biceps brachii attaches to, the infraglenoid tubercle. I'm sorry, the supraglenoid tubercle. And this one down over here attaches to the triceps brachii. Who's heard of a triceps before taking this class? Yeah. So we're going to actually look at those muscles, and these are some important attachment points on the scapula. And on this particular view, which is what kind of view? Anterior? Posterior? Lateral. We're looking from laterally toward the midline of somebody, right? Because here's the glenoid cavity. We see the fossa outlined very nice, like this one right here, subscapular fossa on the anterior side of the scapula, the infraspinous fossa and the supraspinous fossa, because here is the spine of the scapula. All right, so that covers the scapula pretty well. So what attaches to this glenoid cavity right here? That is, yeah, your upper appendage is attaching there, and in particular, you have one bone in your arm, and that is the humerus. So let's see, how far away do we have to go to get to a humerus? Ah, not very far. Here it is. All right, so a humerus is a nice typical long bone, and you got the proximal and distal epiphysis or epiphyses on the humerus, and then here is the, what part of a long bone is this where the cursor is floating over? That is the diaphysis, or you could say shaft, but the proper name is diaphysis. All right, there are some pieces to this bone that you have to know. This smooth raised area right here. Generally, we call that what we call a smooth raised area on a bone. It's for articulation because other bones are going to articulate and we want these bones to slip and slide over each other, not grind each other down. This is a condyle. Condyle is a rough, smooth area on a bone for articulation. But in particular, since this is a bulge right there, this is the head of the humerus. And then there's a little narrowing just distal to the head. So what is that narrowing just distal to your head on your body? That's your neck, right? So here is the neck. We call this the anatomical neck. It's still a pretty massive part of the bone. It rarely fractures. But here is a narrowing. Again, before we get to the diaphysis, this is what we call the surgical neck. That's probably in your lab list. And this is where the humerus likes to fracture because it's not as big and strong. All right, so between the surgical neck and anatomic neck, we've got some rough raised areas. What do we call a rough raised area? Just a general name for a rough raised area on a bone. And what's the function? A rough raised area is for muscle attachment. The general name is process, right? But these processes have a special name because they're on the humerus right here and they're very prominent. We call these tubercles. One is big, so that's the greater tubercle. And this is on the anterior humerus. Right, the lesser tubercle is smaller, and look what we have between them. We have a groove. And what's another name for a groove in anatomy? A sulcus, right? So here's the intertubercular sulcus, and there's a part of the biceps that goes through this intertubercular sulcus right here and attaches or inserts into what? The supraglenoid tubercle on the scapula that we just talked about. So that will make good sense for you in a little bit. Here's another rough raised area, but this is mid-diaphysis on the humerus. And it's a process. So what's the general function of a process? Muscle attachment. And from the name of this, you know now the name of the muscle that attaches right here. That is the deltoid. That's a big, strong muscle on the superior part of your shoulder that can that can elevate your arm up like that. We haven't talked about anatomic motions yet, but we will pretty soon. All right, so that's most of the humerus, though we do have some structures down over here. So these are smooth surfaces for what kind of function? If it's a smooth raised area on a bone, for articulation, right? So these you could call condyles, just like this up over here, the head of the humerus is really a condyle, but they have a special structure, and they articulate with two bones in the forearm. And exactly how many bones do you have in the forearm? You do actually have two, okay? And we're going to look at those next. So on the humerus, it's pretty easy to tell which part of the humerus is medial and lateral. So over here, what is this, medial or lateral? Medial, because it's attaching to the scapula via the head, and so here's the lateral side. These prominent features of the bone that are superior to these condylar surfaces are what we call epicondyles. So anytime you hear epi, that means on top of. Like what? Epidermis is what you're familiar with. It's what? On top of the dermis. And hypo means below. So these epicondyles are rough raised areas. These are for muscle attachment. But these condylar surfaces are for articulation. So the lateral one, notice that this is the lateral side of the humerus. That's going to articulate with the lateral bone in the forearm, which is the radius. We're going to look at that in a second. And this thing over here that looks like a little spool that you could wind some thread or fishing line up, right? We call that the trochlea. These have special names because these are special condyles. They have a special shape because the elbow can do a number of nifty kind of tricks. All right? It can act like a hinge joint for flexion and extension. But the other thing you can do is that you can turn the palms of your hands so that they face posteriorly. That happens at the elbow as well, all right, which is kind of a more of a rotation move. We call that pronation and supination, and it has to do with the shape of these condyles. So the condyle that articulates with the radius, which is lateral, is called the capitulum. It just looks like a sphere. And the condyle that articulates with the ulna is the trochlea. All right, so piece those bones together so you can be familiar with it. But if you don't see a really clear picture in your mind how that articulation works, then you have to memorize that. Okay, you got to memorize capitulum and trochlea and which condylar surface articulates with which bone in the forearm. All right, so that's a really important joint to know about. All right, and on the posterior side of the humerus, we do see an extension of the trochlea. All right, but we don't see the capitulum whatsoever. So what bone articulates with the capitulum? The radius. And what articulates with the trochlea? That's the ulna, right? All right, so that's pretty much it for the humerus. So here is a really nice picture, a zoomed-in region of the elbow. We can see the humerus. We can see the capitulum and trochlea. Here is the head of the radius. Right, and it's a nice depression. There's a depression in the head of the radius that accepts the capitulum. And here is the ulna, which is the medial bone. And the ulna forms like a hook on the proximal epiphysis. The anterior part of the hook is called the coronoid process. And what you cannot see, but maybe on the next slide you can, is the posterior side of the hook. Does anybody know what that posterior side of the hook on the proximal epiphysis of the ulna is called? That's the olecranon process, right? And that actually forms this point right here on your elbow that you can see. That's a nice exterior landmark, a superficial landmark that's easy to see. Now here you can see the epicondyles, nice and easy again. All right, so when you bend your arm, we call this flexion. When the forearm, right, when you bring your hand up to your shoulder, then this coronoid process has to have a dimple in the humerus. Right, otherwise it's going to break the humerus. This, right, what do we call a depression or a dimple again? A fossa, so this is what we call the coronoid fossa because it accepts the coronoid process on the radia when you flex your forearm. All right, and then this is going to be the radial fossa over here, not labeled, I don't think you have to know that, but you see a little fossa right there that accepts the head of the radius. All right, now if we think about the posterior side of the ulna, what was that superior part of that hook called? Olecranon process. So when you straighten your arm out, we call that extension. All right? That olecranon process has to fit into a depression as well. So here is that big olecranon process. It's big and massive because a big strong muscle attaches there, and it's a muscle in your posterior arm, that's the triceps, attaches right here on the olecranon process. So that fossa on the posterior side of the humerus is called the olecranon fossa. So they're named together. That's really nice. Okay, so that's a little bit about the elbow. And now we can see the two bones in the forearm. They're connected by a ligament we call the intraosseous membrane. It doesn't immobilize these bones, but it stabilizes them together to some degree because these bones can actually cross over each other when you supinate and pronate your forearm. So this cannot be an immovable joint, otherwise you couldn't pronate and supinate. Here is the head, the neck, and tubercle of the radius. So this is going to be lateral. And then we have a little styloid process down over here that you can feel on your wrist that helps form the wrist joint between a couple bones in the wrist. You got another styloid process on the head of the ulna right here. Notice that the head are in opposite positions on the radius compared to the ulna. All right, so the head is round on the radius and the head of the ulna is round as well. That allows for supination and pronation. All right, so this anterior process on the ulna is what we call the coronoid process. Here's the olecranon process, and that forms a hook that what does this hook in the ulna articulate with? Do I have a picture of it? Oh, I don't have a really good picture. Okay, we would need a nice lateral view. All right, it articulates. So here's the ulna. What condyle on the humerus does the ulna articulate with? It's the trochlea. So that hook part of the ulna is called the trochlear notch. All right, so here's trochlear notch. That articulates with the trochlea. So hopefully that's starting to make a little bit of sense. All right, so these are the two styloid processes. The one on the ulna is very easy to recognize. It's a little bit harder to recognize this as a styloid process on the radius because usually a styloid process is what? Really long and narrow. This process on the radius typically doesn't look so long and narrow. Okay, so that's good for ulna and radius. Oh, here it is. All right, so here is the trochlear notch that articulates with the trochlea on the humerus. Here is another notch, just inferior to the trochlear notch. And so what bone are we looking at right here? The ulna. Yeah, it's the ulna because we have that olecranon process that forms your elbow right there. And so this is the medial bone. There's going to be a bone lateral to the ulna. What's the bone lateral to the ulna? That is the radius right here. Look at this area right here. Here's the head of the radius, and it's touching the ulna, and it touches right here on the radial notch. So that's a depression. That's a fossa. We just call it a notch. And that's the joint that allows for the rotation of the radius when you pronate and supinate, or at least one of the locations where that happens. So the head of the radius can rotate right in this notch over here. All right, so remember that the radial notch is on the ulna. All right, and the head of the ulna fits into a notch on the radius. All right, so let's name that little notch right here on the radius. All right, so if this is the radial notch on the ulna, what is this notch on the radius? It is the ulnar notch on the radius. So just like when we name processes, right, that reach out and articulate with another bone, we don't name the process by the bone that it exists on. We name it by the name of the bone that it is articulating with. Like on the temporal bone, there is a process that reaches anteriorly and touches the zygomatic bone. So what's the name of that process on the temporal bone called? That's the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. And what's the name of the process that courses posteriorly on the zygomatic bone that touches the temporal bone? Yeah, it's the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. And we put those two processes together, what do we get right here? The zygomatic arch, right, made of those two processes. All right, so I might have a picture of, this distal radial ulnar joint, which is right here, and here we can see the ulnar notch in the radius, which accepts the head of the ulna. And again, you can see the styloid process on the radius and the styloid process on the ulna right here. So if we look at this distal epiphysis of both the radius and the ulna, which one of these two bones is much more massive? Is it obvious? One is bigger than the other? Which one is bigger? The radius is really big, right? It's really massive. This articulates with some bones of the wrist. And you have to know at least one bone on the wrist that articulates with the radius. All the bones of the wrist are what we call carpal. So here's just a little surface anatomy. You can see the two styloid processes. And these are the bones of the wrist that we call carpals. There are a number of them. The one that I want you to know is this one right here, which is the scaphoid. Let me go forward. Okay, so here is the scaphoid. So all of these eight bones are carpals. This is the one you have to know because in lab, anybody remember why I mentioned that one in lab? Because sometimes when you trip and fall, you catch yourself with your hands, and what's the big massive bone that crashes into your wrist? It's not the ulna, it's the radius right here, and it has a tendency to fracture the scaphoid because it has this little narrow piece right there. All right, so that's why it is noteworthy to know. The other thing is that this also illustrates that bone is what kind of tissue? Is it just dead tissue or living tissue? It's alive tissue. It's living tissue. It has living cells called, what are they called? Osteocytes, right? And of course, those cells need oxygen and nutrients that it gets from blood. And when the scaphoid is fractured, it damages that blood vessel. And typically then, or sometimes, frequently, a scaphoid will degenerate, will die as a result, and then the bone dissolves away, and you don't have a really good, or at least not a normally functioning wrist after that point in time, okay, because that blood vessel gets damaged. So don't forget, bone is living tissue, and as a matter of fact, all the bones in your body, what happened to all the bones in your body every 5 years? They're rebuilt. They're totally broken down, and they're rebuilt again in the ways that are beneficial to your body. So if you exercise, your bones get rebuilt how? Big and strong, right? If you're sedentary, your bones are rebuilt weaker and thinner. So to protect yourself from osteoporosis, what should you do? Exercise to keep your bones strong, as well as the proper diet. We mentioned that before. All right, so here are carpals of the wrist. Bones of the hand are not called carpals. They're called metacarpals, and they're named 1 through 5. If you have 5 digits, and a digit, don't forget, is a finger. All right, starting with your great finger or your thumb. All right, so 1 through 5. So this would be the fifth metacarpal. All right, so those are bones of the hand. Bones of the wrist are called carpals. Bones of the hand are called metacarpals. And bones of the fingers are called phalanges. And now you got a whole mess of phalanges right here. Starting with the number 1 digit, you only have 2, proximal and distal phalanges. And then the remaining 4, 2, 3, 4, and 5, you have 3 bones. You got proximal, middle, and distal phalanx in each of those digits right there. Okay, so it's really easy nomenclature, but a lot of students maybe think it's so easy that they don't pay attention to it, and they miss it on a practicum for some reason. So it's really easy to count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? You've been doing that for 20, 30, 40, 50 years already, all right? But don't forget how to do it on a practicum, starting with thumb number 1. And the other thing is, of the digits, where digits are made of phalanges, but the hand is made out of metacarpals, and the wrist is made out of carpals, right? So make sure you understand that distinction. Okay, so that's the hand, and be sure you can tell a hand apart from a foot, which we're going to get to soon. All right, so here we have a pelvis. All right, and a pelvis is made part of an axial skeleton bone, which is the sacrum right here. There are about 5 fused vertebrae that make a sacrum, and we can see these anterior sacral foramina right here. So here is a sacrum. Here is a little wing on a sacrum that's an ala of the sacrum right here. All right, but that's axial skeleton that we talked about. All right, and then we have 2 other bones that are used to surround the pelvic cavity. So this forms the pelvic girdle. So these are the bones of the pelvic girdle. So this is what we call an os coxae, or a coxal bone. And from lab, remember that the coxal bone is actually 3 bones fused together. Just like the sacrum is 5 vertebrae fused together, a coxae is 3 bones fused together. Superiorly, we've got the ilium. Anteriorly, we got the pubic bone. And then inferiorly, we have the ischium. And they all fused together right in this big depression of the adscoxae that we call the acetabulum, which accepts the head of the femur, just like the glenoid cavity accepts the head of the humerus in the pectoral girdle. All right, so don't forget these three bones, because we name these different processes after the bones that they exist on. Okay, so on this slide right here, we can see the pubic symphysis, joining of the two adscoxal bones. We can see the pubic arch. The pubic arch is a nice landmark that you can use to sex a pelvis. You can actually tell a female and male pelvis very easily. So this looks like a female pelvis to me, because this angle between this pubic bone and this pubic bone is greater than 90 degrees. Right? We mentioned that in lab, so this is a nice female pelvis. Oh, anybody remember what the name of this hole in an adscoxae is? Obturator foramen. All right, so here is the iliac fossa. This is for holding abdominal organs. All right, and then we have an arcuate line that is coming down over through here. That defines the true pelvis. Anything below this arcuate line and this arcuate line over here, so in this region right here, that's the true pelvis. All right, and there's also a false pelvis. So above the arcuate line, if we go up here to the iliac crest and kind of draw a line down to the pubis right here, that's what we would call the false pelvis, because it is included in the pelvis right here, but it's not below this arcuate line. All right, so this arcuate line defines the pelvic brim. So we could look into the pelvis from above. This is what we call the pelvic inlet. And if we look into the pelvis from below, that would be called the pelvic outlet. Just a difference in view. Okay, so some features of an adscoxal bone, I guess you have to know all of these. This is a good exam figure. And for the Wednesday labs, I made this a quiz, an extra quiz. And I'm going to delete either an online quiz or a lab quiz if the quiz that they took today or will take today is a better score. All right, so it's a replacement. So it's not really like extra credit, but it's sort of like extra credit. You don't have to take it. And so the Monday class gets gypped out of that particular quiz. So what I'm going to do for the Monday class is give you an extra quiz on the last lab period after the practicum. But it will be something that will help you get familiar with material for that practicum and for the last test. So it will have something to do with reproductive structures or something like that. So even the Monday class will have that extra quiz that will replace a dropper. So if you miss a lab, you can replace it with the one that this extra quiz. All right. So, but even though you didn't have a quiz on this bone, you got to know it, like you had a quiz already, right? All right. So the ilium is which bone of the adscoxae? It is the superior bone. Which is the inferior one? Is the ischium, and it's posterior, and then the pubis is anterior, right? And it's a little bit, certainly it is inferior to the ilium right here. All right, here you can see the acetabulum. You can see the lines of fusion between the ilium, ischium, and pubis right here very nicely, and that accepts the head of the femur. All right, so the pubis we said is anterior. So these spines right here, what bone are these spines on? Right here and right here. They're on the ilium, right? It's color-coded ilium right there. So here's the anterior superior iliac spine, and then here is the inferior iliac spine. But it's also on the anterior side. You have corresponding spines on the posterior side of the ilium. So here's the superior and inferior iliac spine. You can notice those. All right, on the posterior aspect of the adscoxae, we see some large notches right here. Here's the greater sciatic notch, lesser sciatic notch. All right, and then here is another spine, but it is not an iliac spine. What kind of spine is that? That's an ischial spine, right? Because you see it now on the ischium, no longer on the ilium. And so don't get these iliac spines confused with this ischial spine. There's only one ischial spine. All right, so in lab, you've got to take this adscoxae. If you haven't had lab yet, this is really confusing, I'm sure. You got to take an adscoxae, throw it up in the air, put a lot of spin on it so it comes down in some kind of random fashion, grab it, look at it, turn it around so you see the superior part, inferior part, take it, and what? Model it on your body. Put it on your body the way it belongs, and then it will start to make some sense, right? Or take it up to the skeleton at the front of lab and put it on the skeleton and see how you have to turn it and twist it to make it fit on a real body. All right, and a two-dimensional picture really won't do a really good job. All right, so this is, what kind of view, medial or lateral? Because of the acetabulum right here, there is this flaring of the ilium that kind of looks like a wing, all right, and that's the ala of the ilium. On the inside, it forms a depression. So this would be the ala of the ilium, but on the inside surface, the medial surface, it forms a depression. What do we call a depression in anatomy again? A fossa, that would be the iliac fossa. All right, it's really the ala, but since it's forming a depression, we call it a fossa. All right, so don't forget the greater sciatic notch and lesser sciatic notch, and what do you have right between them? The ischial spine, and that's just a singular spine all by itself. We have a rough raised area on the ischium, and that's called the ischial tuberosity. And it's a really rough area. So what's the function of this area right here? Muscle attachment. And you better believe they're big, strong muscles, because what are they doing? They're holding up your whole body, right? And these are muscles in your posterior thigh that attach right here. We'll look at those in the next chapter. So here's the body of the pubis, the body of the ischium, and then what do we call a part of a bone that's at a 90-degree angle compared to the major body of a bone? The ramus. So here is the inferior ramus of the pubis. Here is the ischial ramus of the pubis. Sometimes we might want to call this the superior ramus of the pubis. It's not labeled on this slide, so you probably don't have to know that. Okay, so here is a nice medial view. Here is the depression in the ilium. We call that the iliac fossa. Iliac crest, again, big, powerful muscles attached right here, as well as these different spines here and here. Here is a nice articular surface that articulates with the sacrum, right, that's between the coxae, and then here is the articulation between the two pubic bones. So this is the articular surface. So anytime you see articular, you want to think of what? That's a joint, right? That's a joint between bones. All right, and again, you can see that arcuate line forming. Anything below the arcuate line would be the true pelvis, and then the false pelvis would include just kind of an imaginary line from this iliac crest down to the pubic bone. All right, so this is noteworthy because it forms a special structure of the appendicular skeleton, namely what? The coxae forms the pelvic girdle, right, which completely surrounds the pelvis. So it's analogous to the pectoral girdle, which attaches the upper appendage to your axial skeleton. All right, so here you can see the true pelvis in this. Looks like kind of a funky yellow color. What is that? Orange. Ah, okay, yeah, that would be really funky yellow. And then up over here, this kind of demarcates what? The false pelvis in this, like, pink or something color. Right? Gray. Right. I tried. Okay. So that's how we would define the true and false pelvis. And what outlet is this from below? Oh, well, that's not what outlet. No, that's... doesn't make sense. That is the outlet. Here is the inlet from above. Okay. Okay. All right, so now we can move down to some bones of the lower appendage per se, and we're interested in first a femur. All right, but the slide is a little bit out of focus. Right in your knee, there's a bone that's a sesamoid bone, and it's small, and it's kind of triangular shape. That is the patella. Sometimes we call that the kneecap. One surface is really rough and the other surface is really smooth. All right, and it has little dimples or facets. So what's the function of this posterior surface of the patella since it's smooth? It's just a condylar surface. It's for articulation. And this rough surface right here on the anterior side is for muscle attachment. Powerful muscles in your anterior thigh insert into the patella, and then there's a ligament that goes from the apex. So this kind of looks like a triangle. The point of a triangle is called the apex. What's the flat part of a triangle called? That's the base, right? So this is the basilar region of the patella. Here's the apical region of the patella. The rough surface is for attachments of either ligaments or tendons. There's a ligament that goes from the apex down to the bone in your leg right here, which is called the tibia. We'll look at that in just a little bit. All right, so don't forget patella. Make sure you look at that in lab. All right, so here's the posterior surface, and there's the anterior surface. For some reason, students mix that up. When I put that on a practicum, sometimes they say vertebrae. Okay? But make sure you know what a vertebrae looks like. All right? So that just means, unfortunately, somebody's freaking out on a practicum. And you don't have to freak out. Just take a deep breath. You got plenty of time. All right. So here is the analogous bone to the humerus. But what part of the body is this? This is your thigh, exactly right. Right? It's not your leg, it's your thigh. And this is the femur. So here's the proximal, and then distal epiphyses looks a lot different. And which side is medial? What about where I have my cursor right now? Is that medial or lateral? That's lateral, because the head of the femur is inserting into the acetabulum, which is in the, well, it's made up of all those three bones of the acetabulum, but it's definitely medial. And here's a nice condylar surface that we call the head. There is a pretty marked depression in the head of the femur, which we can't see very well, but in lab you'll see that little depression right there? Call that the fovea capitis. So sometimes a fovea is like a little fossa. It's another name for fossa. There's a very strong ligament that attaches the head of the femur to the acetabulum so that your leg doesn't do what? Doesn't fall off. Okay, but it's held on by very powerful muscles, but that's one way of thinking of it. And there is a blood vessel that goes through that ligament that supplies blood to the head of the femur. Sometimes when you have a hip injury that damages that ligament, then it destroys that blood vessel. And what did we say? What happens to the scapula when it loses its blood supply? It dies, and then it atrophies, it dissolves away. And as a matter of fact, the head of the femur can then die and dissolve away when that blood vessel gets damaged, right? And so then you can imagine what you need to do for a hip then, because it goes away. You need a prosthetic hip, right? You need a hip replacement when that happens. And in lab, we'll talk about that a little bit more, because that happened to a very famous athlete. And he was so phenomenal that he could play both professional football and professional baseball the same year. So maybe some of you know him or heard of him. And he got tackled really hard probably at one point in time, and it damaged his hip, and he needed a hip replacement. And he was such a fantastic, amazing athlete that even with an artificial hip, he could go back and play professional baseball. So in lab, I'll tell you who that is. It might come to you before you have lab. Yeah, some of you might know who that was. All right, so here's the head. That narrowing is the neck. And then you have tubercles on the humerus, but here's the analogous structure. Right? These are what we call trochanters, because they're even bigger. So greater trochanter, lesser trochanter. And again, what's the function of these trochanters right here? Muscle attachment, because they're really processes. And then there's another process on the posterior side of the diaphysis of the femur right here, but it's not really, it doesn't stick out very far, and it's really long. We call that a line. Right, so a line is a process for what kind of function? Muscle attachment. We call that the linea aspera, at least in this region right here. All right, so I don't think you have to know all of these different structures for lab. I'm just going over the ones that you have to know. All right, now in this distal epiphysis, we see some condylar surfaces right here. What's the function of these condylar surfaces? Articulation, so that these bones can move very nicely, smoothly over some other bones. So here is a condyle. Now, which one is this, medial or lateral? And how would you know? It's lateral, because you just look at the head of the femur, right? So here is the medial condyle right here. And what does epi mean? Above or on top. So here are some processes on top of the condyles. And so here is a lateral epicondyle. Here's the medial epicondyle. And again, these are for muscle attachment. Here is a notch between these condyles on the posterior side of the humerus. You could call that the intercondylar notch or intercondylar fossa, this depression. Okay, these condyles are going to articulate with a bone in the leg, which is the tibia, which we see right here. On the anterior side of the femur, there's another condylar surface, and we call this the patellar surface, because guess what it's articulating with? Yeah, the posterior side of the patella, or your kneecap right there. All right, so that's pretty much it for the femur. So what body region is this in? That's your thigh? Yeah, so now let's go down to the leg. Just like in your, what's between your elbow and your wrist? That's your forearm. So just like your forearm has two bones, your leg also has two bones. a medial and lateral one. And probably you should just memorize this. Look at it maybe 10 times every day before the practicum so you don't forget which one is medial or lateral, because other parts of these bones are named medial or lateral, and you want to know. But if that doesn't work, you can always palpate your leg. And the tibia, you can actually feel with your fingertips. You have a hard surface, and you have a nice sharp ridge sticking out right here. That's sometimes we call that the shin, right? If you bang your leg on something, it hurts like hell, right? Because it gets contused. That is the tibia, which is medial. The lateral bone, you can't feel because it's surrounded with muscle that you just can't palpate through. All right, so on a test, if you want to palpate your leg, that's fine. All right, and what are you feeling? You're feeling the tibia right here, which is the medial bone. The lateral bone is just all muscle. Okay, so you have some condylar surfaces on this proximal epiphysis of the tibia that articulate with the condylar processes on the femur. But you also see a couple little ridges between the condyles. We call that the intercondylar eminence. And you're going to realize that's a really important process, because certain things attach right there. And some of you have probably heard of these things already. They're called the cruciate ligaments that stabilize the knee. Right? There's an anterior and posterior cruciate ligament. And when we say cruciate in anatomy, guess what we're talking about? What's the kind of structure that should sink into your mind when we say cruciate? It's going to be an X. They cross over each other. So there's a couple ligaments that cross over each other and attach to these intercondylar eminences. There's another rough raised area on the anterior tibia right here, and we call that the tibial tuberosity. And that's where a ligament attaches. This ligament goes from the tibial tuberosity to the patella, and then the patella has ligaments that go from the basal area of the patella to big strong muscles in your anterior thigh. Some of you might know those are called the quadriceps. Right? So we're going to look at the quadriceps eventually in a couple weeks. So that's an important muscle attachment, the tibial tuberosity. This anterior border is very sharp, easy to damage. And then, just like we had the styloid processes that help form the wrist joint, we have a couple processes that form the ankle joint. These are much bigger and massive, so we don't call it a styloid process. We call it a malleolus. And this is where it could get confusing if you forget which bone is medial or lateral, because the medial malleolus is on the tibia and the lateral malleolus is on the fibula. Okay, in lab you have to know the difference between the head and the lateral malleolus on the fibula, and also know that it is a fibula compared to a tibia or humerus or radius or ulna. So that's really the only thing on the fibula that you have to know. But just like there is a radial ulnar joint, there are fibular tibia joints. Here's the proximal one, and then here's the distal one. These are immovable, because what can't you do with your leg? You can't pronate and supinate, right? If you do that, then you're going to hear a lot of cracking and breaking sounds and be really miserable, okay? So these are more immovable joints. And I suppose that makes sense, because it is holding a lot more weight, right, than your radial ulnar joints, which is not holding up very much weight at all. And that should also tell you something about the hip joint compared to the shoulder joint. Which one do you think is stronger? The hip is a lot stronger for a number of different reasons. The acetabulum is what? Very deep compared to the glenoid fossa. Glenoid fossa is very shallow, all right? But there is a trade-off. Sometimes when you design a system for a particular purpose, you have to sacrifice other kinds of aspects, all right, in the design. So if you design a joint that's very strong, what is something that you're giving away? What is something that your hip is not really good at doing that your shoulder joint is really good at doing? Motion, freedom of motion, right? Your shoulder has a lot more flexibility, which is good, but what is the negative trade-off? It's not as strong. The hip has little flexibility, but it is strong, and that's because of the shape of the joints. All right, so it's easy to disarticulate a shoulder, really hard to disarticulate a hip joint. Okay, so that's pretty much it for the fibula and tibia. Here you can see the articular surfaces, the intercondylar eminence right here, and the medial and lateral malleoli. And again, there's an interosseous membrane between them. So that takes us pretty much to the foot. Okay, so here is the lateral malleolus, here's the medial malleolus, and you can see how it forms an ankle joint very nicely. So these bones right here form the ankle. So if you think of the foot, think of bones that make the ankle, make the foot per se, and then what else? What else do you have on your foot that you need bones for? What do you have? I haven't heard it yet. Just like I heard it, digits. All right, maybe a lot of people said digits. Just like your hand, what are the bones of the wrist called? Carpals. Bones of the hand are metacarpals, and bones of the digits are phalanges. All right, similar kind of situation in the foot, okay, but a little bit different nomenclature. The bones of the ankle are not carpals, they're called tarsals. The bones of the foot per se are not metacarpals, but they are metatarsals. All right, and they're named just like in the hand, starting with number one with the great toe, which is the big toe. All right, so let's take a look at a foot right here. So here's a couple different aspects of a foot. So all of these bones are tarsals. In the wrist, I only wanted you to know one in particular carpal, but in the foot, I want you to know the names of two tarsals. All right, too bad we don't have another joint like that, because then I'd want you to know three bones and then four bones. But in the foot, there's two that you have to know. The bone that articulates with the fibula and tibia is the talus right here. So that fits up between the malleoli, forms a really nice joint that can flex and extend and can bend a couple other different ways that we'll look at. And then the bone that makes the heel is the calcaneus. So I want you to know that talus, which is a superior bone, and then this posterior inferior one is the calcaneus. And you can see that this calcaneal tuberosity is a big, massive process. So you can imagine what its function is for muscle attachment. You have very powerful muscles in your posterior leg that can pull the calcaneus up, which then pushes your toes into the ground when that happens. Okay, and that sometimes, what attaches here, sometimes we call it the calcaneal tendon, but other people call it the Achilles tendon. Maybe you've heard of Achilles tendon in your posterior leg that attaches to the heel bone right here, or calcaneus. You got to know calcaneus and talus. The bones of the foot, starting with the great toe, these are metatarsals, 1 through 5. All right, so in lab, make sure, absolutely sure, you can tell the difference between a hand and a foot. It doesn't look like it's difficult, but it is for some people. So make sure you know the difference between them, right? And then the bones of the digits are phalanges, just exactly like you have in your hand. The number one digit only has two, has this one right here, which is the proximal number one phalanx. Phalanx is singular. Here is the distal number one phalanx of the foot. And if you're going to be really particular, if you have to write a medical report or something, what else would you want to say? In lab, I'm not going to ask you this, but what foot is this? Yeah, this is the right foot. Okay, so for sure you'd want to do that. On practicum, I'm not going to test you on that. But is it important to know the difference between right and left in real life? Absolutely, right? So if you had a family member that has diabetes and they're losing their toes because it's losing blood supply and it has to be amputated, you certainly don't want to take off digits from the wrong foot, right, if it's right or left. And if you don't know, then if somebody doesn't know, then you just have to stop and figure that out, right? If it's not on the chart, look for a big red X and magic marker or something. Okay. All right, so that's how we name these things. A foot has different arches, which then support your body weight. All right, so let's take a look at some of these arches. The medial longitudinal arch that goes from your heel to your toes, all right, and we have a lateral longitudinal arch, all right, so that's the arch that we're pretty much familiar with. That arch just helps support these bones, all right, to support your body weight. And there's also a medial longitudinal arch. There's also a transverse arch that moves from right to left on the foot. And again, all of these arches are designed to support your body weight. Without those arches, then the foot has a hard time distributing body weight, and it causes problems for people because these joints degenerate. All right, so I think that is pretty much it for, oh, I didn't move this slide along. That's pretty much it for appendicular system. Okay, so that's it for appendicular system. So we have some time. You want to look over anything? Anybody have any questions regarding either the axial skeleton or appendicular skeleton? Let me show you some things that are online for you. You can really have a field day online. All right, but before we go, let's look at this picture. Let's just quiz you really quick. What bone is this right here? That's the tibia. And this is the fibula. Now, is this fibula medial or lateral? It's lateral, so this point right here is sticking outside your body. That's a nice landmark. What is this landmark that you can palpate very easily? That is the lateral malleolus. Okay, medial malleolus we can't quite see because what bone is in the way? Why can't we see the medial malleolus? What bone is this? Yeah, that's the talus right there. And then we got this one down here. That is the calcaneus, right? So that's kind of the level that you want to be able to see. All right, so what bone is this right here? Now, is that, what is that, a foot bone, an ankle bone, or a toe bone? That's a foot bone. What do we call a foot bone? Metatarsal. Now, which one is that? That's the fifth metatarsal, right? Because here's your little toe. All right, so what bone is this right here? That's the number, which one? Number two, middle phalanx. Okay? And that would be your right foot. You don't have to know that necessarily, but just kind of keep that in the back of your mind. So what would be this bone right here? That's a, which number? Number one, metatarsal. All right, so you just took a practical exam on something that you haven't really seen much before today. All right, ooh, what was I going to show you? Oh, online stuff. Ah, really good, thanks. All right, so let's get a web browser working. I don't know which one works best on this. Let's try Explorer. Okay, so with Explorer, and I didn't put a button, I'll put a button in Blackboard. Go to my website. How do you get to my website? dr-j-gober, right? That's just my name. And then hit what? Control, Enter. Should take you there. And then here is a nice video on disarticulated skull bones. So disarticulated skull bones, you probably have to know for lab. You can right click, all right, save target as, download that video to your hard drive so you don't have to have internet access all the time, or play it right in your browser, okay? If you save it on your desktop or in your file someplace on your computer, let's open it in a new window. You probably want to play it in a DivX player, which will always run the video and audio tracks together. I've never had a problem with that. I don't know what the computer is running here. It's probably playing it in a Windows Media Player, but at least we get the video track. I don't know if we have the audio. Can you hear the audio track? Okay, that turns up the microphone as well. There's an audio track that goes along with this. All right, but you can skip ahead, and it just is a flash quiz that shows you a bone, okay? And you should be able to identify with that bone. Ooh, what was that? Temporal bone. All right, what's that bone? Mandible. So it's really fast, so you can go over all the bones of the skull in just a matter of a minute, right? Oh, that was a lacrimal bone, all right? And maybe we want to review ethmoid bone. So just make sure that you have a nice picture in your mind where are these different bones. Was there a bone? I missed it. Look like a palatine.
Yeah.
Zygomatic. All right, but you can stop it, right? You can pause it. Ah, there we have an inferior nasal conchae. So you can review all of these bones. Now that's on my website. Now Blackboard also has many super exercises. So let's go to Blackboard. Did I pass a sign-in sheet around?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Where's that sign-in sheet at? Is it up in the back someplace? Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. So let's go to Blackboard, just for fun, and, ooh, I don't have a link for it right here. Favorites? Yeah. All right, so let's log into Blackboard. So Let's do that. Then I want to tab. So week 4, 5, and even week 6 have a lot of nice interactive links. So let's just go to maybe week 5. So weekly assignments. And then week 5, these are no longer activated for you because you're over that part of the class. So here's week 5, which is appendicular system, which is what we covered today. First page is just objective. Second page, labeling exercises. Look at all these labeling exercises you can do on the foot. And let's try some of these. How about something really difficult, like an ascoxe? Let's maybe open that in a new window. Maybe some people use this to practice for the quiz today. It's a little small for my liking, so in a browser, what do you hit to make something bigger? Control plus makes it bigger. Okay, so you can zoom in. All right, so here we see a couple ascoxe. Oh, what's this hole right here called? Obturator foramen. Do I see it? I don't see it. Is it there someplace? Down. Oh, it's off the screen. I made it too big. Ooh, well, it won't scroll. Oh, here, right there. Okay. Live demonstration. Always fun. All right, so what's this over here? Acetabulum. Right, so you can do a lot of nice drag, drop exercises. It's relatively easy to do that. All right, so let me put that away. So you got all these, look at all these different exercises you can do. We have some animations of various parts. Here's a good, this is just another online book that you can read with, and it has good interactive exercises as well. All right, so hold on you guys. I'll let you out really soon. These are your practice quizzes for the online quiz, but I can sometimes lift these off and put them on the test. All right, the Get Body Smart tutorials. This is another online book. All right, bone review. It has all the bones in the body. You can review a number of processes right here, but this is what I really wanted to show you. Dr. Commando's interactive bone exercises. Let's save it. Let's open it in a new window right here. Okay. So you can look at vertebrae, skull, femur. Which one you want to look at? Scapula. All right, which is kind of a difficult bone. We looked at that today. So here's a nice picture of the bone. Do we have any other options? No, just this. What view is this? Lateral, medial, posterior, or anterior? It's posterior because this is a thing you bump into when you give somebody a back rub. All right, so here is the medial border. And look, when I hover over the picture, look what happens to the illustration. It highlights, probably in a red or something. And if you want to know what that's called, click, just left click, and then you see the name pop up in this little box right here. So obviously, medial border. Okay, what is this right here? This is the scapular spine, or spine of the scapula. And then the acromion process, glenoid fossa. Let's see what if they call it a fossa or cavity. I like fossa. Your book says cavity. Ooh, it says cavity here. Okay. I don't know if this is labeled. That's going to be the infraglenoid tubercle. It's not labeled. But here is a depression underneath the spine. That is the infraspinous fossa. Here's the supraspinous fossa. And then maybe you see a little bit of the coronoid process right here, coracoid process right here. So you can run through all of these really nice. And if you want to find a structure and you don't know where it is, you can also just click on these, okay, different regions, and it gets highlighted. So you can go the other way. So this is a really nice interactive tool. All right, this is from somebody that has at a junior college near Phoenix has developed that site. So that's a really nice exercise. So please don't forget to look at all those nifty things in Blackboard. Okay? All right, so that's it for today. So Monday we're going to do joints. So that probably means you have a pre-lecture reading assignment for joints to do. Some nomenclature you should learn before lecture that will really help you out in lecture. Oh, I forgot to mention, no SI today because the SI leader is out on an absence. But maybe Friday, she might be back on Friday, so you'll have to stay tuned. I'll send out an email announcement.